Welcome to the show where truth takes the mic, where the world spins fast, but we hold it tight. This is the Howie Silbiger Show on Truth Talk Radio, where the real ones go. Oh, politics, passion, the news of the day, no filter, no fluff, just the Silbiger way. So buckle up tight, let the debates flow. This is your hour, the Howie Silbiger Show. Silbiger Show. Silbiger Show.
And it's good to be back. It's always good to go away, but it's always great to be back. And I'm happy to be back here in the studio with you here on the Howie Silbiger Show on the True Talk Radio Network. And I appreciate you spending the time with me and tuning in. It is very nice that you're here. And we have a lot to talk about. It always seems that whenever I go away for a week or two, the entire world changes. And that's really what's happened since I left. It's amazing. It's amazing how quickly news moves when you're not around to cover it. And I'm glad to be back. And forgive me if I'm recapping some old news. It's just I wasn't here to report it when it originally happened. I wasn't here to comment on it. So I like to go back a little bit and talk about some of the stuff that's happened. So we know that the U.S. has brokered a peace agreement, well, at least a ceasefire agreement, with Hamas. This happened last week. And part of the ceasefire agreement was that Hamas had to release the hostages that were remaining alive and return the dead hostages. They released the living ones, and the dead ones are coming in slowly. It's taking time for the dead hostages to be returned to Israel. Mainly because I guess they don't know where they are, or they do know where they are, but they're buried and they can't get to them. And the reason I'm calling it a ceasefire agreement is because it's not a peace agreement. It's definitely not a peace agreement. Because there's no guarantee of peace. In fact, the ceasefire has been broken by Hamas already. So it didn't even last a week. And Hamas already attacked the Israeli soldiers, killing one. And so it's not really it's kind of a shaky deal. That's what I'll call it, a shaky, shady deal. The thing that bothers me about this, and I'll be honest with you, this is what really bothers me about this, is that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, believes that he has full control over Israeli actions. So now that he brokered this peace agreement or this ceasefire agreement with Israel and Hamas, he believes, the president does, that he could do whatever he wants and say whatever he wants, and he has full control over the Israeli government. The other day he tweeted or put up on Truth Social or wherever he puts out his messaging that he will allow Netanyahu to attack Gaza again if they break the peace or ceasefire agreement. I'm sorry, I keep slipping back into peace agreement. It's not a peace agreement. That he will allow them to do it? Why would they ask him permission? If the ceasefire is broken, Israel has every right to retaliate, every right to continue their campaign to destroy Hamas. The American president who brokered this deal with Hamas basically saved Hamas. Now, this is not the first time America's done that. I don't know if you remember. Some of you may be old enough to remember. But before the Oslo Accords in 1991, the Palestinian Liberation Organization was a dead organization. They were totally decimated. And the government of Yitzhak Rabin and Bill Clinton in the United States decided that Hamas was not the government they wanted to deal with. It was not the people they wanted to deal with. They had won the elections in Palestine, whatever. They were running the show, basically. And they didn't really want to deal with them. So they resurrected the PLO and had a sham election after the Oslo Accords in 93. And Mahmoud Abbas has been prime minister or president or whatever he calls himself since. So it's interesting to think that the failure of the Oslo Accords and the American brokered peace of the Oslo Accords, that nobody's learned their lesson in 30-odd years, that we're going through the exact same thing here. Hamas has found time. They have bought time to regroup, to reorganize, to restock, to rearm. And then they will be back attacking Israel again. Because the signing of a piece of paper and the agreeing to give some hostages that were a pain in the butt for them anyway back to Israel is not a deterrent for them to give up on their ideology. And their ideology is extremely clear. It is the destruction of Israel and the murder of all Jews everywhere. So we have to be clear on this. We have to understand that this is a temporary measure, not a permanent peace. This is not going to bring Israel or the Middle East into a new era. This is not going to change the situation on the ground for Israel or for any of the other countries in the region. And this is not going to better the people, the lives of the people of Gaza. In fact, it worsened the lives of the people of Gaza. Just take a look at what's happened. In 24 hours after Israel and Hamas signed their deal or agreed to their deal, Hamas started executing their opponents in Gaza. Now, it's not the first time they've done that either. Because when they had the election and Hamas had won the leadership of, they won the government of the Palestinian Authority, and Israel and the Palestinian Authority at the time, the former Palestinian Authority, the ones who lost the election, and America decided that this was not what they wanted to see. These weren't the results they wanted in a democratic election. And we know it was democratic because it was supervised by former President Jimmy Carter. So we know it was a democratic election, of course. And we know that at that time, in that time period, America and Israel did not want Hamas running the Arab areas that were given to them by the Oslo Accords. And so they orchestrated a coup d'etat. They orchestrated an overthrow of the Palestinian government. Hamas won by majority the leadership of the Palestinian Authority. And with America's help, the PLO pushed Hamas into Gaza. This is the actual history of what happened. This is how Hamas ended up in Gaza. They pushed Hamas into Gaza. They pushed legitimately elected government of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians voted and legitimately elected Hamas. And America and Israel decided that they wanted the PLO instead, and they pushed Hamas into Gaza. Now, that would make anybody upset. I would be upset, too, if that happened to me. An overthrow of my government, me being exiled into a little portion of land when I had control of all the land, that would be a little upsetting to me. And I'm sure it was very upsetting to Yahya Sinwar and the other Hamas leaders. And so Hamas regrouped. They said, okay, we're in Gaza, let's regroup. And they had a civil war in Gaza. And the civil war, they massacred every single pro-PLO person who lived in Gaza. They murdered them. Murdered them in the streets. Murdered them in their homes. Murdered them in their schools. Murdered them anywhere they were. They just killed them. And if that wasn't bad enough, the PLO started killing Hamas supporters in Judea and Samaria. And so the civil war continued until Hamas was in Gaza and the PLO was running the rest of the lands that were given to the Arabs during the Oslo Accords. Cool. So Hamas won the election, got exiled into Gaza, beat the PLO in Gaza militarily, and then started waging a war against Israel from Gaza, which culminated in the October 7th attack and then the subsequent war that had been happening for 2 years after that. Now, we know the history, So now we understand the history. We have to understand that this hard-earned status that Hamas had worked for years, for nearly 30 years to maintain and to gain and to maintain, is not going to be given up because Donald Trump said stop. They're not going to stop with their ideology of killing Jews and destroying Israel. That's just not disappear. That doesn't just disappear. It's like saying when the Allies beat the Nazis, the concept of Nazism just vanished, that people just forgot about Nazism. That doesn't happen. The people of Europe didn't forget about Nazism, and the people who bought into the philosophy of Nazism continued to hold on to that philosophy, continued to believe that that was the correct philosophy, and continued to teach their children that that was the correct philosophy, that Jews were subhuman, and that Nazism, that Hitler did not finish the job. This was right across Europe. Nazi-occupied Europe, people who bought into philosophy didn't forget it when Hitler died, didn't forget it when Nazism was defeated. Didn't just walk away from the ideology. They were raised in it. Kids who were raised in Hitler Youth were raised in the ideology. How could you stop an ideology? You can't. And if people believe in it, they are going to continue to fight for it. And the people of Hamas believe in the Hamas ideology. And the Hamas Charter, you can find it online. Go ahead and read it. I urge you to read it. Calls for the destruction of the State of Israel and calls for the killing of Jews anywhere they live. And that's not an ideology that disappears quickly, not an ideology that disappears at all. And so the indiscriminate killing of Jews everywhere is exactly what the pro-Hamas protesters are yelling for at their protests. When they yell globalized intifada, they're not yelling, let's have an uprising in Israel and let's overthrow the Israeli government. They're yelling, let's kill the Jews everywhere we go. It's code. It's code for killing the Jews. Because the intifada was the indiscriminate attack on Jews in Israel. So if you want to globalize that, then this, you're globalizing the indiscriminate attack on Jews. The murders, the blowing up of cafes, the blowing up of buses, the stabbings and the shootings, the blowing up of supermarkets and of discos. This is what you're globalizing. This is what you're calling to globalize. And the fact that the governments of Canada and the United States and governments in Europe have allowed people to stand in the street and yell for the massacre of Jews should scare every single one of us. We should all be outraged that this has been allowed to continue for 2 years. And you figure once this ceasefire agreement came to be, and that Hamas has agreed that they're going to stop and they release the hostages. And once you figure that Israel's going to stop fighting with them and they're going to withdraw their troops from Gaza, that these protesters would go away. Well, that's not the case. They're just pivoting. Now it's time to turn and say, okay, look, the war is over, but Israel is still an imperialistic pig that has to be destroyed. And so the Hamas charter, which calls for the destruction of Israel and the murder of Jews everywhere, continues in the protests, in the pro-Hamas protests. It continues to globalize. And the governments in Canada and Europe and everywhere else just sit around and say nothing. They just allow this to happen. And that's really what should scare every single decent human being in the world. But there aren't very many decent human beings in the world. We see that over the last couple of years that decent human beings don't exist anymore. It is very unfortunate that there is a full generation of people who could have been raised to be decent, but were raised on TikTok and get their news from TikTok and Twitter and Instagram. It's very unfortunate that these people look at the skewed reporting that happens on there, the skewed videos and the misleading images and messages that are shown on these platforms. And they believe them and they propagate them. And this is how the misinformation and the hatred towards the Jewish people and the hatred towards Israel spreads. And the lies and the blood libels spread. And we allow it to happen because the Jewish community has been impotent. We've done nothing to stop this. We've allowed this to happen over 2 years. There have been a few people who have gotten up and screamed, but other than that, it's been silence. An angry press release from Federation is not going to stop protesters in the street. I didn't see one major protest, counter-protest, a major one, 10,000 people out for counter-protesting anywhere in the world. It didn't happen. You didn't see Jews standing on the street screaming and yelling. You didn't see Jews being proactive. You saw students sometimes being proactive. You saw little bundles of people. But there were no massive rallies. And the only one who could organize such massive rallies are the major Jewish organizations. They chose not to. When you speak to them, they'll tell you, we didn't want to stoop to their level. Well, no, it has nothing to do with stooping to their level. They were afraid. They were afraid of violence. They were afraid they were going to be attacked. They were afraid that the counter-protesters were going to hurt them in some way. But in the fight for the Middle East, in the fight against the philosophies of the Middle East, the first thing you have to understand in that fight is that weakness is the worst thing you could show. That when you choose not to respond, when you choose to remain silent, when you choose to take the high ground, as they tell me they're taking, you're showing weakness. And when you show weakness, you end up dead. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who's this?
Hi, Howie, it's Samara.
Hey, Samara, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I love listening to you talk, Howie.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm so happy our paths crossed in the most unfortunate way, but at least we got a good friendship out of it.
It's amazing. Sometimes you meet in the weirdest ways, but it's great. It's great to have you on the show, Samara. What's up?
How are you doing?
I am excellent.
Let's talk about Candace Owens, because you're talking about misinformation.
Candace Owens. You know, I used to like Candace Owens for a lot of
so
years.
So did my husband, who's sitting right next to me. We used to be big fans.
I remember Candace Owens when she was working for Breitbart, for Andrew Breitbart and Breitbart in his media organizations. It was her, Ben Shapiro, and that other guy. I remember his name. The one who was with Trump, the one who became Trump's chief of staff. I don't remember his name. And they were running Breitbart, and Candace Owens was they were teenagers or just in their early 20s at the time, and they were very, very, very good at disseminating truthful information and fighting against the media mob, but she seems to have taken a slight turn.
Yeah, I don't know. She was a very intelligent, astute, highly critical of and very, very well on point. And then she's gone off the deep end, and I just the misinformation that she's propagating about Jews and about Israel, I find it to be really, really shocking.
I'm disappointed about her, and I'm disappointed with Tucker Carlson too.
Uh-huh.
And I have to think that maybe. I mean, she broke off from the Daily Wire. She was working for the Daily Wire on Ben Shapiro, and then she broke off from them over some anti-Jewish remarks that she had made. I'm thinking that maybe their Qatari backers are influencing the way they're speaking now. And that's my thought, at least.
She was obsessed. You know, she claims a lot that she always goes to the nth degree to do, you know, investigating and reporting, gets to the bottom of things. But she loves to put stuff in the limelight in either in her headings of her shows or things like that are completely not back. She's still in the midst of investigating it, and then she'll just throw it out there, especially when it's anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic content.
Yeah, it's very confusing. It's always confusing when somebody who professed to be pro-Jewish and to support Israel suddenly turns. It's happened a couple times over the years, but I find it very confusing. And you look back at their old stuff and you look at their new stuff, and it's almost like a different person.
Yeah, she's someone. I mean, it would have been good to continue to have her on our side. It would have been helpful to have her on our side. She has exploded.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're getting her back anytime soon. She's gone off the deep end on anti-Semitic.
And once you go over the deep end, you hardly ever climb back up the cliff. It doesn't happen.
Yeah. But I think her, Tucker Carlson, but it's crazy the misinformation that's out there. It's just fascinating. I don't know.
So how do you think we could fight this, Samara? I mean, I do this, and I have the Montreal Jewish News that I disseminate information on. But outside of that, how do you fight this? What do we do?
It starts with our kids and educating them and giving them strong Jewish identities. I think is so important that they just they instinctually know that this is garbage. You know, that this is garbage.
So let me tell you.
I had a good friend of mine who came to my wedding in Israel, educated, very, very, you know, close to me. And when October 7th broke out, we were talking a little bit about the war. Things hadn't even really started yet. And she said to me, and I said, like, you've been to Israel. Like, what do you think? Like, you've been. And she said, only the parts that you showed me. I was like, do you actually think I hid stuff from you? And these are people that I think, like, lack a certain level of confidence in their own relationships or who they are. Like, do you actually think, if you think I'm your good friend and I'm hiding stuff from you, then don't be friends with me. You know, don't. So I think it just speaks to where people come from. And I think it all starts at home. I really do think it starts at home.
But it goes a little deeper than that, Samara. I tell you, like, a few years ago, in 2013 or 2012, I was hired to teach Israel advocacy at a local Jewish high school. And they gave me carte blanche, create the course and teach Israel advocacy, but we want you to teach it as if you're on a university campus and these kids are going to be, you know, defending Israel on campus, right? And I went and I taught the course for 2 years. And after 2 years, I was told by the head of school that the material I was teaching the kids wasn't inclusive. This is what I was told. And they replaced me with a Federation type person, one of the guys from Federation, who came in. And the first class, I remember clearly, I was still working the school. I just wasn't teaching that course anymore. And one of the boys in that course, it was a grade 11 class. And one of the boys in grade 11 came to me and said to me, I need you to explain this to me. I don't understand what this guy's talking about. And the first class they taught was that there's no conflict. There's no conflict between being supporting Israel and supporting Palestine. And that you could support the existence of the state of Israel and the existence of Palestine on the exact same land at the exact same time, and that was what the school was teaching students in an Israel advocacy course. And so you know, when schools do stuff like that, I don't care what you teach them at home, they spend more time in school than they spend at home.
Yeah.
So when schools are influencing kids in that direction, Then how do you expect kids to be able to support Israel or even want to support Israel or be able to advocate for Israel when they leave the bubble of high school and end up in a real world where you have people yelling death to the Jews in the middle of the street?
I mean, I don't know about you, but my high school did not prepare me for any of this. And I went to Jewish high school. They did not prepare us for any of the skills to deal with any of this. And you know, I think that looking back, like, you know, I think having a Jewish identity, whatever, is great. But I think having confidence, being able to, like, you know, to debate and stuff like that. But, I think what it comes down to is, like, Jews, especially ones that tend to be more, I would say, secular and also not even secular, but also ones that tend to work in like academia or education or stuff like that, they have this, like, I call it almost like incestuous obsession with being liked.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. And I remember, you know, going to a meeting with McGill. We had like 15 minutes with the president to speak with Deep Sani. And everyone's like, you know, thank you so much and thank you so much. 10 minutes before we went into that meeting, everyone was saying to us, oh, like, you know, he has 10 minutes. He's barely giving us any time to talk. And it took us like 6 months to get this meeting. Why are you saying thank you? Why are you pretending that you like the guy? You know, like, I'm not saying I'd be an asshole, but like this obsession with trying to be liked, I find. And I see this in academia so much, like being liked by your colleagues and being liked. I mean, I think actually not being liked is actually what served actually the Jewish people the most to get ahead and to, you know, to power through adversity. But this obsession with being liked, and that's why I've said no matter what Israel's response would be at any single time, it won't change the fact. People won't like us. So I don't think it matters anymore.
No, I've been doing the show for just about 30 years now. It's a long time. It's a long time. And in the 30 years that I've been, I was on AM radio for about 18 years doing the same show. And when I was on AM, I used to bring up topics in the Jewish community, topics that, you know, we don't necessarily always talk about, but we should be. Belief in God, child abuse, I mean, stuff like that, that, you know, that's not generally talked about in the community, but really should be talked about a lot more. And I used to get calls all the time saying, you shouldn't talk about this stuff. Why are you talking about this stuff? People are going to hate us. They're going to think that we're crazy. Why are you talking about this stuff? And my response was, look, you know, we're human. And we have the same problems everybody else has in our community. And there's nothing to hide. I'm not embarrassed by the problems, but if we don't talk about them, we can never solve them. So this is the premise of having discussions. And this is why I have a telephone line and people can call in. And I'm more than happy to talk to anybody. Because if we don't have a discussion, then how do you solve your problems, right? And so, you know, there was a lot of pressure to take me off the air when I was on AM because I was bringing up topics people just didn't like. And there was a lot of not liking me in the Jewish community. But as much as people didn't like me, they wanted to listen to me and they wanted to hear what I had to say. And they wanted to hear the topics I was bringing up. So sometimes not being liked is to your advantage.
I know, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. This obsession with being liked, you know, and kind of, like, I see this, like I said, like in institutions and stuff, like don't ruffle feathers. Like, especially as a woman, I get that a lot. It's like, yeah. You're too much of a, you know, of a renegade. I'm like, when did that become a bad thing to speak up and to challenge and ask questions? And I'm not doing it like in a, you know, like most people, like, you know, asking questions is now being seen. Like, if you ask questions, whether it be about, you know, different like federation or different organizations or what their motives are or stuff like that, it's like, first of all, I'm not saying they assume that I'm attacking or that you're criticizing. Step one, I'm just trying to gather data and ask questions. And it's like, even with people online, like, I would never, ever tell anyone, you can't ask me anything. And it's like, you know, it's like, what are we hiding all the time? I don't understand. What are we hiding? It's like, if someone wants my credentials, my phone number, where I live, like, if you want to come to eat at my house, like, I'll message sometimes people online when we're kind of engaging in debate. I'm like, listen, let's be honest. What you say behind the screen is very different when you're having a conversation. So come to my house for dinner. Never will anyone come.
Right.
You know, that's arguing or debating. And I'm like, those are the most interesting conversations. You know, we can agree to disagree, whatever. We can have hot topics.
No, we can't. That's the problem. You know? We can't agree to disagree because that doesn't exist anymore. The concept of agreeing to disagree has stopped, has failed.
When did that stop?
It stopped when the radical left decided to stop it, when censorship came in, when they decided to start shooting people for their opinions. That's when it stopped. You can't agree to disagree anymore because one side believes that what they believe in is 100% correct and everybody else is a Nazi. And if you're exposing anything that they don't believe in, you're a Nazi. And if you're a Nazi, I mean, the second you call somebody a Nazi, you're giving free rein for anyone to shoot you. Because why wouldn't you shoot a Nazi? Of course you shoot Nazis. This is where we've come to. This is where society has come to over the last 20 years for sure. Is that anybody who disagrees with the left is a fascist, a Nazi, or whatever other, you know, horrific insult they could throw at you. And you get some unstable people who believe that, and you end up with Charlie Kirks.
You know, I was thinking a lot about how, like, during the Holocaust, like, all those, like, intelligent people, like doctors and academics and philosophers were, like, some of the main ones, like, performing experiments and stuff like that. And you think about it. But now, like, when I look at, like, some people in academia, I was like, I could see this happening.
Well, if you ever wondered how Nazism happened and why normal people would have bought into that philosophy. Just look at the last 2 years since October 7th and the millions of people that have been in the street yelling death to the Jews. It catches on. It's contagious.
Contagious. It's really, really, really contagious, you know? And but I'm happy that that woman from CNN got fired this week. That was exciting.
Yeah, but it doesn't happen often enough. That's the problem.
It doesn't happen often enough. No, it's true.
They give people like Candace
Owens. My husband just told me, I don't know if you're aware of this piece of information, Howie.
Yeah.
There is talks on the table to start a post-secondary, a university in Ontario, like funded by the Muslim Brotherhood.
I saw that story a couple of weeks ago. And I read that story 3 times. I wasn't sure if it was a serious story, but apparently it's real. And it's scary. And Canada will give them accreditation. I guarantee that they'll get accredited. Because, you know, inclusion,
I'm sure.
Inclusion and multiculturalism, right? It only works one way, though, multiculturalism.
But, like, the yeshivas, I know all the Jewish schools, they have the hardest time, like, getting accreditation when it's something for Jewish schools or anything that's non-secular or, you know.
Forget about that. They're
always,
not funded.
Breathing down their back,
I can tell you that yeshivas are not funded at all. For non-secular studies, so half the day's not funded. And even for secular studies, they only fund partial. They don't get full funding like a lot of other schools, private schools. And their scrutiny, when it comes to renewals, like license renewals and operating renewals, the scrutiny that yeshivas go under are much harsher than any other school in any city anywhere. They, you know, the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law is always applied when it comes to religious schools, and that's really where religious schools are at, in Quebec at least. I don't know about the rest of the country. I don't know about the rest of the world.
Muslim university, I thought getting a program was impossible at a university. Let's just pop up a new university. But it's the funding by the radical, it's the radical terrorism that you know really really scares me. And did you also hear that story about that guy in Hampstead Park? Did you see that one?
Yep, saw that one too.
Yeah, that's all.
When you have a government, when you have a federal government. That really doesn't care about the Jewish community, and this government really doesn't care about the Jewish community, and fans the flames of hatred as this government has done for the last couple of months, or at least last couple of years. Then what do you expect? What do you expect?
Well, I love when this is just like if this was so obvious to me when Trump called Carney president.
Yeah.
And after that, he goes up to him and he's like laughing about it. It's like, you're a joke. You're the prime minister of our country. And this guy doesn't even know your title head. And he's like, you should be happy. Trump's like, you should be happy. I don't call you governor. And he doesn't even have any presence. The guy has no presence.
Even worse than that is that for the signing of the ceasefire accord in Cairo, Carney had to beg Trump to invite him. He wasn't invited. Trump said, hey, you recognize Palestine. There's no reason to invite you. Before Hamas was dismantled and everything else, you recognize Palestine. So there's no reason for you to be here. And he actually had to beg him to be there. So that's a really embarrassing situation for Canada. You know, a country that once stood proud and tall has now fallen. It's sad.
But I don't think, unfortunately, I think Pierre has lost his momentum totally. I think he's lost it totally.
Samara, thank you so much for calling. I do appreciate it.
It was really nice talking. Bye, Howie.
It's great talking.
I'm going to listen. Bye.
Take care. Bye. 1-877-669-1292 is the number to call if you want to get in on the conversation. Feel free to call in. So since we're talking about Canadian politics, let's move into municipal politics because there's a municipal election campaign coming up, and I think we have to talk a little bit about where Jews stand in this municipal campaign, where we should be standing, and why, how we should be voting. I think it's important to understand that there are people running in Jewish neighborhoods that have been very, very, very involved with this liberal government and supporting this liberal government. And I think as Jews, we have to be cognizant that this liberal government has made Jewish life in Canada extremely, extremely difficult over the last little while, especially since October 7th. The governments of Justin Trudeau and the governments of Mark Carney have not been good to the Jewish community at all. Mark Carney recognizing Palestine at the United Nations is just one example of many different things that the Liberal government has done to make Jewish life extremely difficult in Canada, where Canada once was a welcoming, open community. Well, never really welcoming. You know, none was too many was Canada's motto for years during World War II. But Canada was a comfortable place for Jews to live. It's now become extremely uncomfortable to live in Canada. And it doesn't matter which part of Canada you're in. From Halifax to Vancouver to Quebec, Jews have been under attack for the last couple of years in Canada. And the government, the federal government, which really should be fighting this and really should be cracking down and enforcing laws, has failed to enforce the laws that need to be enforced in order to curb this kind of anti-Jewish behavior that has been showing up in Canada, right across Canada. For instance, let me use an example. And by the way, you can read a lot of this, a lot of what I'm talking about, you can read it a little more in depth if you go to montrealjewishnews.com. It's a news site that we set up here at the Howie Silberg Show. We set it up, True Talk Radio. Set up montrealjewishnews.com. Check it out. We delve deep into some of these topics. So check out montrealjewishnews.com if you want a lot more robust conversation about this, about stuff I talk about on the show. montrealjewishnews.com is a great place to go. It will give you a lot more information. You can look up the stuff that we write there. And if we're wrong, we admit that we're wrong, and we're willing to back up on anything we say there. But for the most part, we're right. Now, if we take a look at the candidates in different ridings and in different places that in Montreal where Jews live, we have to understand that there's a whole lot of them that have been involved with Liberal politics, with the Liberal Party of Canada. Now, the Liberal Party of Canada, which is the ruling governing party right now, has historically, not just recently, historically, has not stood up for the Jewish community at all. And it's always been a mystery to me, the same way it's a mystery to me why Americans vote for the Democratic Party, it's always been a mystery as to why Jews in Canada vote Liberal. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's totally nonsensical, but that's what happens. This has been the tradition. It's starting to shift now. We've seen the last few elections, the Jewish community has shifted a little bit, but they haven't shifted enough. Now, I don't generally take sides. I like to stay neutral when it comes to Canadian politics, at least, because Canadian politics has always been lame. But it is not the time. We are not at the time. We are not in the time period where we can remain neutral anymore, where we could just talk generally about politics. We have to understand that the timing that we're in right now, it's either critical. There's two critical things that we have to think about. The first critical thing is, if we decide that we're going to stay in Canada as a Jewish community and not flee Canada because the death to the Jew crowds are still marching in the streets, if we decide we're going to stay in Canada, then there's a couple of things we have to think about. Safety and security is one of them. And if the federal government isn't going to provide safety and security for the Jewish community, then we have to start thinking about, can we really stay here? Not do we want to stay here. Can we really stay here? Can we really exist in a country that is actively allowing people to call for the death of the Jews openly in the streets? Now, a lot of people are going to argue with me, oh, Howie, they never call for the death of the Jews. Really? Think about it for a second. They're calling to globalize the Intifada. I know we spoke about this before. I keep going back to this because this is the main point. They're calling to globalize the Intifada. So for those of you too young to remember the Intifada, I'm not. I remember the Intifada. And I remember the fear and the terror that was put into the hearts of the people living in Israel while these intifadas were happening. So intifada is Arabic for uprising. And the uprisings that happened in Israel in the 90s, when the intifadas happened, were basically this. A bunch of young school children got onto a school bus to go to school, and some crazy, maniacal, genocidal terrorist blew up the school bus. People went shopping in the streets, and some maniacal, crazy terrorist blew up the shopping mall. A bunch of kids went into a coffee shop to get a piece of pie, and some maniacal, genocidal terrorist blew up the coffee shop. people walking down the street just minding their own business, stabbed to death by some maniacal genocidal terrorist who are committing jihad and performing the Intifada. And so on and so forth. You want to go on a city bus? Sure. Sure, but the city bus blows up because some maniacal genocidal terrorist blew up the city bus. This is what the Intifada was. And when they call to globalize the Intifada, this is what they're calling to bring to every city in the world. That Jews can't walk in the street. Jews can't exist in their buildings. Jews can't walk into a shopping mall without the fear of being killed. We can't mince words anymore. We can't work. We can't work on generic terminology. We can't work on being inclusive and loving with everybody. We have to understand where we stand. And where we stand right now is right there. The target of a crazy genocidal ideology that's taking root and taking root quickly in Canada. So far, we've seen attacks. The globalized Intifada movement has worked, and the crazies have started attacking. We've seen schools shot at, some shot at multiple times. Chaya Mushka School in Toronto was shot 3 times in the course of a couple of weeks. Yeshiva Gadola in Montreal was shot 2x in a couple of days. United Talmud Torah was shot. Firebombs thrown at the Beth Tikva Synagogue, firebombs thrown at Federation, firebombs thrown at the MK. The attacks on the Jewish community are not random. They're part of this global movement to globalize the Intifada. Now, we'll go back in history a little bit if you want. I have no problem doing that. In the early 90s, in Ville Saint-Laurent, the United Talmud Torah Library was firebombed on the eve of Pesach, Passover Eve. The bomber, at the time, left a note on the door saying, "I threw the bomb into the school as a retaliation for Israel killing the leader of Hamas." He was arrested. He was a young kid. He was arrested. He was 17, 16, 17 years old. He was arrested. His mother tried to ferry him out of town. She was arrested. And Canada had passed. So this was the early 2000s, 2003, I think. It was somewhere around 2000s. And Canada had passed the terror legislation law just after 9/11. They refused to use it. They absolutely refused to use it for a guy who threw a Molotov cocktail through the windows of a Talmud Torah school and left a note saying that it was politically motivated. The criteria for using the terror legislation in Canada was a political attack on an identifiably religious institution or person. The time, the Justice Minister, Liberal Justice Minister, Erwin Kotler, ordered the charge to be arson. He later told me privately that he regretted doing that, but politics are politics. So there we go. So the Liberals have not been very good to the Jewish community for a very long time. Yet the Jewish community continuously votes in Liberal candidates and continuously votes for the Liberals. Let's take the most Jewish riding in Quebec. The most Jewish riding in Quebec is the Mount Royal riding, whose Liberal MP Anthony Hausvater has won multiple elections there. And before him, and before her, and before him, and before her, and before him, has been a Liberal riding for nearly 100 years. It's been a Liberal riding for a very long time. The Mount Royal riding includes Hampstead and Côte Saint-Luc. Now, Côte Saint-Luc, the Council of Côte Saint-Luc, and I know them all, and they're all very nice people, but all of them have been involved with the Liberal Party. All of them have campaigned for Anthony Hausvater. All of them are friends with Anthony Hausvater. No problem being friends with somebody. I have no problem with that. He was mayor of the city, and they all served with him, so they're all friendly, and that's fine. That's fine. The mayor of Côte Saint-Luc was the president of the Riding Association, of the Liberal Riding Association, of Mount Royal Liberal Riding Association, until this election where he resigned his position and Sidney Margolyes, a longtime liberal worker, took over as president. He resigned his position because it wouldn't look very good optically if he was president of the Liberal Riding Association, and he ran in this climate where Jews are really not so happy with liberals. So he resigned his position for political reasons, not because ideologically he changed his mind. He resigned his position for political reasons. Every other councillor, pretty much, with the exception, I think, of two, endorsed Anthony Helsfater in the last election. So, in Côte Saint-Luc, there's a choice. Only two councillors got it claimed. Everybody else has somebody running against them. So, there is a choice to choose between supporters of the government, enablers of the government that has not been very nice to the Jews for a very long time, or other people who aren't affiliated with liberals who could run the city and not be tied at the hip to the liberals, to the liberal MP. Now, this is a choice that Côte Saint-Lucers have to make. I don't live in Côte Saint-Luc. I don't make that choice. But this is a choice that Côte Saint-Lucers have to make. There's only a couple of Jewish people running for council in the city of Montreal. One of them is Sonny Moraz. And Sonny worked for Anthony Helsfater. He was Anthony Helsfater's chief of staff. So he worked for Anthony Helsfater. And not only did he work for Anthony Helsfater, but during one of Helsfater's liberal campaigns, Sonny was accused and convicted of destroying opposition flyers. So these are the people who are running for council. And the Jewish community has to make a decision. Is this the kind of people that you want to be running your cities? Is this the kind of environment you want to live in? Now, while these people may be great at running the city, their affiliation with the Liberal Party, who have been more than not nice to the Jewish people, should disqualify them for the Jewish vote, at least. That's the way I think. Now, that's my personal opinion, and you could take it and leave it for whatever it is. But that's my personal opinion. When we look at the people who are opposing them, so Mitchell Brownstein has an opposer. The guy running against him is David Torchman. David Torchman was a candidate for the Conservative Party. So essentially, in Côte Saint-Luc, you have a proxy vote going on, where Liberal Mitchell Brownstein, who was the president of the Liberal Riding Association, is running against former Conservative candidate David Torchman. Who's going to win? I can tell you. We'll find out in November. But it's going to be an interesting race. That's for sure. If you take a look at Jeremy Levy, who's been very, very pro-Israel, he has two competitors, Bill Steinberg, who's also been very pro-Israel, and what's the other guy's name? Jack Ettore, of course, that's his name, and Jack Ettore, who's running for mayor. Jack Ettore is a longtime Hampstead councillor. He's also a great guy. Jeremy Levy is a great guy, and Bill Steinberg I've had on the show numerous times. He's a nice guy too. So I really, Hampstead is kind of an anomaly because the three guys running for Hampstead all have to be pro-Israel. Now I'm not saying that Mitchell Brownstein isn't pro-Israel in the Côte Saint-Luc, but he is definitely supporting a non-pro-Israel government. A government that's really anti-Israel, a government that has pushed itself away for being ally of Israel. And anyone propping up that kind of government should be scrutinized by the Jewish community. And so I think that Jews living in Côte Saint-Luc should be looking at the record of the people running in Côte Saint-Luc. It's very important. And I really strongly believe that people should be held accountable for their political affiliations. And that affiliation is absolutely part of their campaign, even though it has nothing to do with them, their ability to run the city. But it should absolutely be part of their campaign. it's important. You want to read more about what I think and what some of my staff thinks, you could go to montrealjewishnews.com, montrealjewishnews.com, and there's full articles there outlining everything, outlining and expanding on everything I just said. So please feel free to look at that and use that as a resource, and always check everything we write, check everything I say. Never take anything at face value. I learned a long time ago that that face value, taking things at face value, is not prudent, and it's not safe. That always research, always check it out, always do your own research. Never believe anything you hear. All right, that's it for me. Until next time, I want to wish you a great week. I should be back on a little later on in the week, but if I'm not, I will see you again next show. Until then, have a good one. I'm Howie Silberger. Don't forget to check out montrealjewishnews.com, and I'll see you soon.